Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're embarking on really an extraordinary journey into a true story from World War II.
We are. We've got sources here, including a pretty powerful sermon titled Love That Suffers, and, well, historical accounts, too, that really flesh out this event.
Right. And our mission today is to dig into these, pull out the key insights, and help you understand how something like compassion can just emerge, even in the heat of intense conflict.
It's a narrative that really challenges, I think, our basic understanding of human nature. It pushes you to consider some profound questions about empathy and maybe something more, what the sermon calls a deeper kind of love.
Okay, let's get into it. So the story begins December 20, 1943, a really critical time in the Allied bombing campaign over Europe. Tell us about the setting, the specific mission.
Well, our main focus is on a young American pilot, Charles Brown. He was just 21 years old.
Very young.
Yeah, a farm boy from West Virginia, actually. And this was his very first bombing mission. His plane was a B-17 bomber.
Ah, the Flying Fortress.
Exactly. Known for carrying huge payloads and, well, supposedly being able to take a lot of damage.
And on this day, Brown and his crew people, like co-pilot Spencer, Pinky Luke, radio operator Dick Peashout, ball turret gunner Sam Blackie Blackford, and quite a few others.
Right. They were flying their specific B-17, which they'd nicknamed the Pub.
The Pub.
They took off from Kimbolton Airfield in England, their target, Bremen, North Germany. And they were flying high, really high, 27,000 feet.
27,000 feet.
Yeah.
Just incredible. So they're heading to Bremen, a dangerous mission anyway, but things started to go wrong pretty quickly for the Pub, didn't they?
They did. They were maybe about 6 miles, a bit over 6 miles from the target when they just slammed into the thick wall of anti-aircraft fire. Fleck?
Right.
Charles Brown knew instantly they were hit. Badly. A huge hole was just blown right in the nose of the plane, sheared off a big section of the plexiglass.
And the cold.
Unimaginable. The temperature inside the plane just plummeted. 76 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Minus 76. It's hard to even comprehend functioning in that. And that wasn't the only damage, was it?
No, not at all. That was just the start. They took another hit, knocked out one of their engines, or at least caused it to seriously malfunction. But somehow, they kept going.
They pushed through.
They did. Reached Bremen, actually managed to drop their bomb load, but then, you know, the real fight began. Just trying to get home.
Because the plane was severely damaged.
Critically crippled, losing altitude fast, they quickly fell behind the rest of their squadron. Suddenly, they're completely alone, deep over enemy territory.
That must have been terrifying. Yeah. Damaged, losing height, alone. But the danger wasn't just the failing aircraft, was it? Something else happened.
That's right. Just when you think it couldn't get worse, suddenly a swarm, 15 German fighter planes descend on them.
15 against one crippled bomber.
Exactly. And they were relentless, just started tearing the Pub apart with machine guns, cannons. Half the crew got injured in this attack. And tragically, the tail gunner was killed. The whole plane was shaking violently. Charles Brown said later he could feel an enemy plane just like chewing up his tail section.
Chewing it up.
Yeah. And he didn't even realize the extent of it at the time. His entire left horizontal stabilizer, that's like a 5-meter wing on the tail, it was almost completely shot off. Just a 1-meter stub left.
How could they even fly? That sounds structurally impossible. What happened then?
Well, it almost was impossible. The Pub went into this deadly, uncontrolled dive, just plummeted, dropped over 23,000 feet almost instantly.
3,000 feet.
Yeah. Charles, just pure desperation, dug his heels into the rudder pedals, pulled back on the control yoke with everything he had, just sheer force of will almost.
A.M.
And incredibly, the wings responded somehow. The plane stabilized, then kind of surged forward. It leveled out literally just above the treetops.
Just above the trees.
Close enough to blow leaves off branches, shingles off roofs below. People on the ground, German civilians, apparently just looked up, stunned, kind of forgot to run for cover for a second.
Amazing. So the German fighters, they must have seen the dive, thought it was over.
That seems to be the case. They broke off the attack, probably figured the Pub was finished, doomed to crash any second. But against all odds, it stabilized somehow and just lumbered towards the coastline.
Still in terrible shape, though.
Oh, absolutely. Captain Brown, Charles Brown, he really feared the worst. He actually gave the order for his crew to bail out, figured a POW camp was a better bet than, you know, being blown out of the sky or crashing.
Did they jump?
Not one of them. In this incredible moment of loyalty, really, every man chose to stay. Stayed with their captain, stayed with their plane.
Wow. Staying together. And then just when they think they might have a sliver of hope, another German plane appears.
Yeah. A lone German Messerschmitt 109 fighter. This must have felt like the end.
And the pilot of this 109.
This was Franz Stigler. Now, Stigler wasn't just any pilot. He was a battle-hardened ace. Very experienced, very decorated, and he needed just one more kill.
One more.
One more confirmed kill to win the Knight's Cross, Germany's highest award for valor. A huge deal.
And here's this crippled B-17, basically a sitting duck.
Exactly. Ripe for the plucking, as they say. And you have to understand Stigler's perspective, too. He wasn't actually a Nazi Party member, but he was a loyal German pilot. He'd seen the devastation American bombing raids caused.
And in personal loss, too.
Yes. He had lost his only brother earlier in the war, shot down by Allied aircraft. So here's this opportunity. Revenge, perhaps, and definitely the Knight's Cross.
So it looks like a completely foregone conclusion. Shoot down the bomber, get the medal. But that's not what happened.
Not at all. What Franz Stigler saw when he got up close to the pub, it was different.
How so? What did he see?
He saw a plane utterly shot to pieces, just riddled with holes, gleaming silver where the paint was gone. The waist gun position was completely blasted away, just gone.
And the crew.
Through the torn fuselage, through the exposed ribs of the aircraft, he could see them. The American crew huddled together, desperately trying to care for their wounded buddies.
Seeing the human element.
Exactly. Something shifted for Franz in that moment. As he positioned his 109 just off the pub's right wingtip, looking at that blown away nose, seeing the state of the men inside, something just happened in his heart.
He couldn't do it.
He couldn't. Even though they were the enemy, even though they were bombing his country, even though his brother, he just couldn't bring himself to fire. He said later he felt it would be blatant murder. Not combat, just murder. Went against his own code, his honor as a pilot.
So what did he do, if not attack?
This is the truly astonishing part. To the utter amazement of Charles Brown and his crew, Franz Stigler flew his fighter in formation right alongside the pub.
Alongside them, why?
He started guiding them. He flew positioned in a way that would help shield them, visually at least, from German anti-aircraft gunners on the ground along the coast.
So the gunners on the ground would see a German plane.
Right. They'd see the German 109 escorting the bomber, maybe assume it was captured or surrendering, and they withheld their fire. He effectively protected them, escorted the B-17 out towards the North Sea, aiming them towards England.
Incredible. He risked his own life doing that.
Absolutely. If he'd been caught, seen by another German pilot reported, it would have been execution, almost certainly.
And then what? He just flew with them all the way.
No. Once they were clear of the German coastal defenses, out over the relative safety of the North Sea, safe from immediate attack, Franz Stigler simply pulled alongside one last time, gave the American crew a salute, and then peeled away. Departed.
Vanished.
Yeah.
Wow. That act. It just beggars belief.
Mm-hmm.
And this takes us right to the core of that sermon, Love That Suffers, doesn't it? This idea of loving your enemy.
It really does. The sermon talks about this really radical concept of love, which isn't just affection. It's this self-sacrificing, unconditional, give everything you've got kind of love. That's really what Franz Stigler showed. He risked absolutely everything, his life, his reputation, everything for his enemies.
The sermon connects this to specific teachings.
It does. It points to verses like Matthew 5:43-44, you know, the famous love your enemies passage, and also Amos 5:15, which is interesting. Hate the evil and love the good. It suggests this love isn't about ignoring wrong, but actively choosing good, even for the one who represents the enemy.
But the sermon pushes further, right?
Right.
Asking if this kind of love is even possible, especially when you're the one being harmed.
Exactly. It brings up the Apostle Paul living under the Roman Emperor Nero. Nero, who was infamous for brutally persecuting and torturing Christians. The sermon basically asks, are you really supposed to love the person doing that to you?
A very hard question.
It is. It's just this agape love, this willingness to suffer for the other, isn't just a nice idea. It's, well, it's almost superhuman. It highlights a profound capacity we might have.
And isn't this, according to the sermon, what Jesus exemplified?
Precisely. It points to passages like Romans 5, Colossians 1, Hebrews 12. All highlighting Jesus's actions. And crucially, Luke 23:33, where even during the crucifixion, Jesus says, Father, forgive them.
Forgiving his executioners.
Yeah. The sermon emphasizes this idea that love is the fulfilling of the law from Romans 13:10, meaning the selfless love isn't just one commandment among many. It's kind of the whole point, the ultimate ethical act.
But how? How is that level of love achieved?
Well, the sermon suggests it's only really possible if you are, quote, rooted and grounded in love, referencing Ephesians 3 and Colossians 3. It implies it comes from a very deep spiritual or internal foundation, something that allows this extraordinary compassion to override base instincts.
But what's the takeaway for us then? How does this apply to how we might deal with people we see as adversaries or even enemies in our own lives?
Our source, the sermon, points to Romans 12, verses 14 and 19 through 21. It presents these almost as a kind of formula, if you will, for how to actively treat enemies, not just passively tolerate, but actively engage with this radical, selfless approach. It certainly challenges you to think differently.
It really does. Now, back to the pilots. Miraculously, Charles Brown nursed the pub back to England. He and the surviving crew landed safely. But the story didn't end there in 1943, did it?
No, not at all. Charles Brown went on, married, raised a family, lived a full life after the war. But he never, ever forgot that day. The image of that German pilot saluting him, it haunted him in a way. He had to know who it was, why he did it.
So decades later, he actually tried to find him.
He did. It was much later, in 1989. He took out an ad, placed it in a newsletter specifically for former German Luftwaffe pilots.
What did the ad say?
It basically described the incident, the date, the location, the damaged B-17, the escorting 101, and asked if anyone knew the identity of the pilot who had spared them. He included his own name and address.
A long shot, surely, after all that time. What happened?
Amazingly, it worked. In January 1990... So, 47 years after the event, Charles Brown received a letter.
No way.
Yes. It was from Franz Stigler. Turns out, Franz had moved to Canada after the war, built a new life, and he had also wondered for all those years what happened to that B-17 crew. Did they make it?
So Stigler saw the ad.
He saw the ad and wrote immediately. Charles apparently started to write a formal letter back, but then just threw it away. The need to connect was too immediate. He picked up the phone, got directory assistance for Vancouver, Canada, and found Franz Stigler's phone number.
He called him after 47 years.
He called him. And that led to perhaps the most incredible part of the story, the reunion.
They actually met.
They did. Charles arranged it. And he brought along some of his surviving crewmates, including Blackie Blackford, the Bull Turret Gunner, and Dick Pinky Pesce, the radio operator.
What must that meeting have been like?
Deeply emotional, by all accounts. Blackie Blackford apparently just broke down crying when he shook Franz Stigler's hand. Thanked him over and over for not shooting them down that day.
And Blackie said something quite profound, didn't he?
He did. He looked at Franz Stigler, the man who held their lives in his hands and chose mercy, and he said, "Because of you, my children and grandchildren were able to experience life."
Wow. Just because of you, my children and grandchildren. That hits hard. It brings the whole love that suffers message full circle, doesn't it? The ripples of one compassionate act.
It absolutely does. And the sermon connects this right back to that passage in Matthew 5, the verse immediately following, love your enemies. Verse 45 says, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven.
Suggesting that acting with this kind of love
is how you truly embody that higher purpose, that connection to something greater. It implies that loving your enemy isn't just about them. It's about fulfilling your own potential as a human being, reflecting something divine.
Well, this deep dive into such an incredible piece of history and the message it carries,
yeah,
it really does make you stop and think. The story of Charles Brown and Franz Stigler is just a stunning testament to compassion found in the most unlikely of places.
It really challenges us, doesn't it, to think about what love truly means, especially when it demands real sacrifice, when it goes against every instinct of self-preservation or even, you know, justified anger or revenge. It's a potent reminder that our choices, our actions, they can resonate for generations.
So thinking about this whole deep dive, what stands out most to you when you hear Blackie Blackford's words, because of you, my children and grandchildren were able to experience life? What does that spark in your thinking about how these seemingly impossible acts of agape love can create a legacy that stretches so far beyond just one moment in time?